Hello, today is Thursday, June 11, 2026. This is a continuation of an article from last time. U.S. law enforcement warns of anti-tech extremism as AI hatred grows. Daniel Bogoslav, source Wired. Sight is a for-profit private intelligence firm that monitors social media for its law enforcement customers. It promises to do an incredibly difficult, if not impossible, job, consistently mining social media written by anonymous posters, full of in-jokes, slang, different languages, vagueness, and so on, to deliver credible information that can predict threats, Reynolds says. Instead, this type of activity tends to focus on people's views about things like policing, abortion, economic inequality, vaccines, or any other hot-button topic of the day. By narrowing our OSINT focus exclusively to communities with a proven link to real-world harm, even trolling remarks have an informative value, demonstrating sentiment within a community toward a target, and our reports have shown a notable spike in online threats and advocating for sabotage against data centers, which is a true cause for concern, Rita Katz, founder of Sight, tells Wired in an email. The documents obtained by Wired also show that fusion centers are currently keeping tabs on in-person assemblies. The Northern Virginia Center generated a report about demonstrations at local civic events, including the Arlington County budget meeting and the Fairfax County School Board meeting. Across the country, town halls and budget committee meetings have been among the chief forums for local residents to express their dissent with data centers being built in their neighborhoods. According to Data Center Watch, a project by AI security firm 10A Labs that tracks opposition to data centers, hundreds of organizations across 42 states have organized to block data center construction in their towns and counties. These efforts are often contentious. In California, Illinois, Indiana, New Jersey, Oklahoma, and Wisconsin, state and local police have removed or arrested speakers at town halls who criticize data centers, in one case before they were even allowed to speak. Under U.S. law, domestic terrorism is not a standalone crime that is brought to bear during trial. Instead, domestic terrorism laws allow for targeting and surveillance of extremists, with charges sometimes bearing terrorism enhancements and sometimes excluding them altogether. This has led to protesters and activists being surveilled under domestic extremism provisions while being charged with crimes like criminal trespass and vandalism. The zeroing in on anti-tech activity by federal agencies is evident in an invitation to a lecture by extremism researcher Mauro Lubrano, circulating in fusion centers across the country. Lubrano has emerged as one of the foremost experts on anti-technology extremism. He is the author of Stop the Machines, The Rise of Anti-Technology, which describes three main strains of a newly minted threat matrix: insurrectionary anarchists, eco-extremists, and eco-fascists. Lubrano's book identifies followers of Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, German Arnicists, Mexican eco-extremists, and far-right fascists in the Terrorgram Collective as distinct but aligned components of an emerging tech extremism movement. In Lubrano's analysis, these groups are united by the fact that they have all plotted or carried out acts of violence in furtherance of their ideological goals. Lubrano said he was not surprised that his lecture turned up in a fusion center, but cautioned that any anti-tech extremism framework must be exercised carefully. I hope the warning I, along with other colleagues, raised is being acknowledged. While anti-technology violence is unacceptable, it should not be used as an excuse to securitize AI and emerging technologies, thereby silencing those who are critical of the current trajectory, Lubrano tells Wired. But Spencer Reynolds says that despite the real, if limited, threat posed by these groups, a category like anti-tech extremism could be drawn so broad as to ensnare peaceful data center protesters, AI skeptics, and anyone with a bone to pick with technology that permeates modern life. As people continue to organize for a better future, we are likely to see more surveillance and criminalization of this opposition, just as we have of Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, and environmental movements in recent decades, Reynolds says. A January 2025 DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis report furthers this perspective by attempting to connect Luigi Mangione, the alleged assassin of UnitedHealth CEO Brian Thompson, with Kaczynski. Law enforcement reports that the individual may have drawn inspiration from Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and his anti-technology beliefs, the report reads, without offering further evidence. It concludes with a warning alleging that executives are at a heightened risk for targeted acts of violence or threats of violence when they are perceived as taking advantage of individuals of lesser means. But perhaps the clearest-cut example of how nonviolent critiques of technology can be swept up and flagged as a threat is found in an open-source report circulated by Site Intelligence in April 2025. The report flags a video from the progressive nonprofit More Perfect Union on the destructive effects of a data center to nearby residents in Georgia. Nothing in the video advocated for violence against property or people, but thanks to Fusion Center targeting, the advocacy group is now circulating among U.S. intelligence and law enforcement across the country as a potential threat vector. AI agents plunged the tech world into chaos. Here's exactly how that happened. Stephen Levy, Source Wired. Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a cloudholic. It was August of 2025, and Peter Steinberger was addressing a meetup in London called Cloud Code Anonymous. Steinberger and some fellow addicts had arranged the event to network with people like themselves, techies swept up by coding tools such as Anthropic's paradigm-busting Cloud Code. I dedicate pretty much all my waking time to this, yet it doesn't feel enough, he told the gathering in a cozy brick-walled room. A few months later, Anthropic released a new version of Claude Code, and the ranks of cloudholics exploded. Called Opus 4.5, it could handle more complicated programming tasks, retain much more in its memory, run for many hours on end, and manage a team of AI sub-agents. Anthropic has what it describes as a notoriously difficult take-home exam for prospective engineering hires in a head-to-head comparison of those people and its models. Anthropic claimed that Opus 4.5 scored higher than any human candidate ever, which raises questions on how AI will change engineering as a profession. Countless coders spent the holidays in basements and dens, madly trying out this new toy that let them build software as if they'd unleash 100 clones or unlock superpowers. It feels like becoming Spider-Man, one told me. For the 39-year-old Steinberger, who split his time between homes in London and Vienna, even this was not enough. In November of 2025, he launched a tool that's now called OpenClaw, a simple way to conjure a personal AI agent that exploits the advances of Claude Code or other coding tools. give it access to your data, your apps, and maybe even your credit card, and it scours your cloud and ventures until the web to do your bidding. It can run autonomously in the background and overcome obstacles with the persistence of the Terminator. Steinberger's project took off midwinter. One indicator of popularity is the number of stars a code repository gets on GitHub. In less than 2 weeks, as users downloaded it and began feverishly building, the project racked up more than 100,000 stars. As of early May, it stood at 366,000 stars. With those two breakthroughs, the commercial product Claude Code and the open source OpenClaw, the long-awaited age of AI agents has suddenly arrived. At least for those technically proficient enough and perhaps foolhardy enough to go all in on a messy, imperfect, and risky adventure. More than one Claude Holick tells me they feel they are living in the future. AI is here. AGI is here, one fanatic told me, paraphrasing William Gibson's famous quote, "It's just not evenly distributed." Back in the 1980s computer revolution, the general public tended to regard the new machines with a mix of curiosity and angst while the hackers were joyfully building. There's a similar dynamic today, possibly with even more at stake. It's hard to explain how much of a sea change this is, says Thomas Reardon, a former executive at Microsoft and Meta, who now heads a startup focused on a different area of AI. It's the most underrated, massive release I've experienced in technology. Soon we'll all be experiencing it. On a recent podcast, Mark Anderson, the guy who co-invented the browser and has cast himself as the ultimate techno-optimist and MAGA fan, made a proclamation that reflects Silicon Valley's thinking. It's almost inevitable that this is the way people are going to use computers. Left unsaid, it won't be a choice. Roll back to early 2024 when Boris Cherney was an Instagram tech lead working remotely from a house he shared with his partner in rural Japan. I would bike to the farmer's market by the rice paddies, Cherney, who's 34, says. Our hobby was making miso and pickles, and we would trade with our neighbors. All that changed when he started to play with the AI models emerging from his former hometown of San Francisco. He is originally from Ukraine. His grandfather programmed computers with punch cards. The models jarred Cherney from his idol. Through friends, he connected with Anthropic and then moved back to the Bay Area to work there. Soon after Cherney joined the company, an engineer named Adam Wolf showed him Anthropic's work on automated coding. It was very primitive, Wolf says, but Cherney used a coding tool to do a pull request, a common activity in software engineering that attempts to merge new code into an existing code base. It wasn't a good PR, says Wolf, but the attempt meant that good pull requests were possible, and that higher-level coding tasks might soon be automated. Cherney set out to make that a reality. OpenAI and Microsoft had been trumpeting their coding products since 2021, when OpenAI launched its first iteration of Codex. While those tools made programmers more productive, the products were limited and required careful supervision. Cherney envisioned an upgrade where the model understood the architecture of programming and had the wherewithal to solve problems. What Cherney and his team built became Claude Code. Anthropic released a preview in February 2025 and launched it in May 2025, with updates over the next months. For many people, however, the turning point came in November when the company released Opus 4.5. It ran longer, was better at problem solving, and could run whole teams of sub-agents, each working on a different part of a program. At first, the Claude Code team saw Opus 4.5 as an incremental improvement, We've been daily users for over a year, so it was less night and day for us, says Kat Wu, CloudCode's head of product. But Anthropic's tool had reached the coding equivalent of escape velocity. While far from perfect, only fools deployed its work without vetting for errors. It now rivaled or outperformed what a human might come up with. Some opinions we had about how to structure code have melted away because it's easier not to fight Claude, Wolf says. If Claude wants to do something a certain way, you just let Claude do it. Much like how OpenAI underestimated ChatGPT's impact, Anthropic didn't anticipate how the November release would galvanize the techie community. Gary Tan, CEO of the startup incubator Y Combinator, was a convert. I went all the way to the edge of how you could get the most out of Claude code, he says. I was coding at a rate of about 4 million lines of code a year, which is about 90x my best output as an engineer in 2013, basically a team of 90 Garys. A few weeks after we spoke, he updated his estimate. He now thinks he's up to 408 Garys. Ryan Peterson, CEO of the shipping and freight logistics company Flexport, found himself spending less time on C-suite activities or his family and more time playing with Claude code. There's something about watching the agent just doing the work that is mind-blowing, he says. As I spoke to Peterson, I got the impression that the global supply chain crisis in the Strait of Hormuz was less a corporate emergency and more an unwelcome distraction from his sessions with Claude. It's sad because I just want to spend all day building tech and applying AI and partnering with the teams, he says. In a twist that Mary Shelley might appreciate, Journey himself turned into a Claude-holic. Most nights I have dozens, sometimes hundreds of agents running 8 and 12 hours at a time, he told me. I have some agents that run for many days at a time, and they do things like rewrite the code base or improve the efficiency of code. Or, as he said to me at another point, it's like I have a jetpack. I can't stop thinking about it. In early 2025, Peter Steinberger was lost. 4 years earlier, he had sold the shares in his company for a tidy sum and promptly lost his bearings. As he put it in a blog post last year, I did a lot of stuff. I partied hard. I did plenty of therapy. I did ayahuasca. I moved to another country. I wandered around carrying this emptiness in me and hunting hedonic pleasures. Then, in April 2025, he discovered the beta of Anthropic's coding tool. I was really addicted, Steinberger says. I had trouble sleeping. As transformational as Claude code was, it still required monitoring from the command line in a terminal, a persistent relic of computing's Jurassic roots. If Claude hit a snag while Steinberger was out and about, he couldn't immediately fix the problem. Steinberger started to imagine a code-savvy factotum with access to Claude or Codex that you could use on your phone, perhaps through Slack or WhatsApp. He figured that a digital assistant with access to your apps and data could automate a huge range of tasks. To plan a party, for example, it could look at your contacts and email, figure out whom to include, send invites, and order the food. Steinberger dusted off a prototype of a tool that would let you access your computer terminal on your phone and started building using Codex. OpenAI had upgraded its own programming tool to compete with Claude code, and Steinberger often preferred it. After a few hours of tinkering, he had an agent that could make use of the best AI coding tools. I just prompted it into existence, he says. Steinberger was startled by the skill set of his creation. On a trip to Morocco in November 2025, he accidentally asked his agent a question using a voice memo. He had designed the agent to accept only text or images. It just replied, he says. I asked, how the hell did you do that? The agent responded that it recognized the input as an audio file and found programs to decode it, understand it, and act on it. That was a moment where I was like, holy hell, he says. He dubbed his tool Claude, and in late November, he released it on GitHub as open source. Since every great open source product has a mascot, he made Claude's a lobster. At first, the uptake was slow, but a few weeks in, he took a chance and introduced his agent to a public Discord. Anyone on the Discord could have used it to mine Steinberger's personal data, but they didn't. Claude went viral, becoming the most popular open source project in GitHub's history. Viewed on a chart, Claude's trajectory looks like a rocket launch, one stark vertical line. As interest rose, Anthropic decided that the name was too close to its own product, which eventually led Steinberger to remain Claude to Open Claw. The lobster mascot remains. Make no mistake, Open Claw is not necessarily easy to set up. If you don't have a modicum of technical chops and an unhealthy tolerance for risk, it's not for you. But those who enter OpenClaw's world by pasting in the single line of code that starts the installation process have gone bananas building artisanal services to automate their professional and personal tasks. If your work involves, say, placing a lot of orders and awaiting their delivery, you can now set up a system that finds the orders in your email, regularly pings FedEx or UPS for updates, and displays the status of all deliveries in the dashboard. When a package arrives, OpenClaw messages you. In the gleeful fog of creation, many OpenClaw fanatics blew past concerns about the risk of exposing their data to an ambitious robot. In a February paper, 20 AI researchers tested OpenClaw and found that it is, to cite the paper's title, an agent of chaos. Observed behaviors include unauthorized compliance with non-owners, disclosure of sensitive information, execution of destructive system-level actions, and numerous other alarming behaviors. Problems emerged in the wild as well. On Meta safety and security engineer made a rookie mistake in an OpenClaw project and watched in horror as her inbox began deleting all her mail. But for all its risks, OpenClaw helped expose a broad swath of techies to the power of an agent. When OpenClaw, the interface is your chat app, WhatsApp, Telegram, or iMessage, for example. It made the models so much more accessible and nice to use because suddenly, like you hatch your agent, you give it a name. It's much more relatable, Steinberger says. David Morin, a former Facebook executive and now a VC, says OpenClaw was life-changing for him. Within seconds of installing it in December 25, 2025, he was in conversation with his OpenClaw agent. The agent asked him a few personal questions and suggested, because he lives in Marin County and is now involved with the woo-woo Esalen Institute, that its name should be Watts, after the late Sausalito-based hippie philosopher Alan Watts. Morin had a job for Watts. In his dining room, Morin had a set of digital photo frames with outdated software, and he was stuck looking at the same pictures. He asked OpenClaw to take a stab. Within 15 minutes, I had a fully functioning web interface for the frames, and I was updating the photos, he says. Morin has since used OpenClaw to manage the software that runs his VC company. As I talk to him, I get the feeling that Watts may be Morin's best friend. Morin sent Steinberger a DM on January 11. "I'm in love with what you've built," he wrote, gushing that Steinberger's idea is bigger than the software. Morin and Steinberger began a friendship that became a collaboration. "I kept telling him that we have to put this into a foundation," says Morin. "You've uncovered the Linux of AI, and it's going to be 6 billion people scale." Together, they co-founded the Open Claw Foundation to help organize the project's maintenance and development. Morin also expects that the foundation would tout Open Claw as an exemplar of beneficial AI. The vision of the foundation is to bring people closer to AI, he says. In the United States, AI is less popular than ICE. In March, Morin and Steinberger found themselves backstage at NVIDIA's GTC Developer Conference. They'd been told that CEO Jensen Huang was going to mention OpenClaw in his keynote. We thought he was going to just do one slide, Morin says. He ended up taking over 10 minutes of his keynote to 28,000 people. In fact, Huang's rhapsodic description of OpenClaw and NVIDIA's adoption of a supposedly more secure and error-free version of it called NemoClaw was the climax of his two-hour speech. Every company in the world today needs to have an OpenClaw strategy, Huang told the crowd. They'll also need to scrape up a lot of cash to pay for this new mode of computing. For one thing, agents are computationally intensive. Using these tools burns what are known as tokens, little chunks of text in a large language model. AI companies generally charge by the token, much as power companies bill people by the kilowatt hour. It's a real dollar investment, says Tan, speaking for Claude Holics, who go full blast. You actually have to spend six or seven figures on tokens. I'm on a run rate to do seven figures this year. Even less fanatic users can easily spend hundreds of dollars in a week. YouTube is full of videos recommending methods to cut down the number. To help run their OpenClaw experiments continuously, people have been buying up Mac Minis, and Apple can't meet demand. OpenClaw users with subscriptions to the standard Claude chatbot were burning so many tokens that Anthropic started forcing them to pay extra. Meanwhile, OpenAI has hired Steinberger to help it bring agents to the masses. While other countries courted Steinberger, Anthropic, he says, never said much to me other than sending me legal threats. Anthropic says they merely sent a friendly email. OpenClaw will continue to be available as an open-source GitHub project with the foundation providing guidance. Anthropic is working on versions of agents that can bring the power of Claude code to users across finance, legal, sales, and more. Its first such product, Claude Cowork, was released in late January. It's uncertain and irrelevant whether OpenClaw will remain at the heart of agent mania. Countless AI companies are on a mad dash to get agents into the hands of anyone with a keyboard or phone. If that happens, the transition, they imagine, won't be smooth. An inability to stem horrendous hallucinations and outright bad behavior might set the timeline to never. The lack of sufficient tools to check an agent's work will continue to be an impediment. But if a widespread rollout does take place, agents could put plenty of human beings out of a job. Success could be painful. Making the most of this transformation will be less of a technical challenge than a cognitive one. Just as internet native users have had an edge in the digital world, those who instinctively automate their world will run circles around those who are reluctant. We may all become Claudeholics or be left behind. Anguished parents, crying doctors, life amid Utah's measles outbreak. Amy Maxman, Source Wired. Ben Douse hadn't expected to treat measles when he became a doctor, but there he was, examining a newborn exposed to the virus in the womb. The infected mother had given birth just hours earlier. The hospital had alerted Douse to the case before delivery, and he'd braced himself for the worst. Douse wore a full-body protective suit with a plastic face mask. As a pediatrician in southern Utah, he couldn't risk getting even a mild infection because many of his patients are babies too young for measles vaccines or children whose parents choose not to protect them with immunizations. I went in looking like a scientist in E.T., he said. The most ambitious future-defining stories from our favorite writers. Measles can cause brain damage, deafness, or death in newborns. If the baby entered the world with a measles rash and fever, Dowse was prepared to give the infant a spinal tap to assess the risk of neurological damage. Luckily, flushed and crying, the baby looked healthy. To keep it that way, Dowse wanted to inject the baby with concentrated antibodies against the measles virus. To his surprise, the parents objected, promising to give their child all kinds of vitamin A, Dowse said. He begged them not to, saying, "You can't see it on the surface, but the baby's body is fighting the measles." They were afraid of vaccines, so Dowse explained that antibodies were different and that they would stop measles from replicating in the infant. "That shot is going to basically give the baby ammo to fight," Dowse said. The parents relented. A couple of days later, they left the hospital with a child who had narrowly skirted an infection that killed many thousands of babies a century ago. Nonetheless, Dow said he doubted they would be returning for childhood vaccinations to protect their baby against a bevy of illnesses. Like more than a dozen Utah doctors and health officials who spoke with the KFF Health News, Dowse has adjusted his expectations. He is part of a reluctant cohort of medical professionals now on the front line of America's regressive next chapter in health history, one in which dangerous and preventative diseases return. "I wish that people could see what I see," says Nathan Money, a hospital pediatrician in Utah whose eyes welled up with tears as he described children he has treated for measles struggling to breathe. "This train is going in the wrong direction, and it can feel like a helpless situation because we're just not seeing the public messaging and leadership that's needed to turn this around." Since measles was deemed eliminated in the U.S. a quarter century ago, public health workers have extinguished sporadic outbreaks in close-knit, under-vaccinated communities with targeted methods, isolate people with measles, and quarantine their contacts to contain the virus. But as vaccination rates drop nationwide, the virus is moving beyond insulated communities, overwhelming public health departments constrained by shoestring budgets. Larger outbreaks, the kind not seen for a generation, has forced health officials into a new paradigm. They have stopped racing to contain infections and shifted gears into what they call mitigation. Utah made that transition early this year. "Once the outbreak hit a point where you no longer have control over it," said state epidemiologist Lasha Nolan. By March, measles had been detected in every health jurisdiction in the state and in northern Arizona. More than 950 people have tested positive in the two states since the outbreak began in August, but many people with measles haven't been tested. A genetic analysis of measles viruses suggested that the true number of cases last year could have been 6.5 times what was known. Last year, under President Donald Trump, U.S. measles cases exceeded 2,000 for the first time since 1992. 6 months into 2026, the U.S. has already surpassed that threshold. Prolonged outbreaks exact a toll on children who have spent days in hospitals for severe infections and missed weeks of school for mild ones. Adults with measles miss work. Parents delay daycare to keep their babies safe. Doctors in Utah have enacted labor-intensive protocols to keep measles from spreading in clinics. Newborns and people with weakened immune systems who have been exposed to the virus receive infusions of concentrated antibodies costing $500 to $1,000. Medical visits for measles can cost more than $33,000 per patient. Health departments spend millions trying to curb infections. "This is like a snowball that gathers speed as it rolls downhill," says Emily Morris, a hospital pediatrician in Salt Lake County and Utah County, a full-throttle campaign to educate communities on the safety of vaccines and the diseases they prevent could turn the situation around, doctors and health officials said. It would require an effort similar to what the anti-vaccine movement has long done in videos, blogs, and podcasts. For example, the anti-vaccine organization that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. founded before taking the helm at the Department of Health and Human Services Children's Health Defense visits vaccine-hesitant communities, produces movies, and has brought advertisements on Facebook that downplay the threat of viruses while wildly exaggerating the risk of vaccine side effects. Kennedy's words and actions as health secretary are adding to parents' doubt. After the development of vaccines and antibodies in the mid-1900s, virologist and Nobel laureate Frank McFarlane Burnett wrote, "One can think of the middle of the 20th century as the end of one of the most important social revolutions in history. The virtual elimination of the infectious diseases as a significant factor in social life." He could have had imagined what was coming. He couldn't have imagined what was coming. Year of sickness. In communities nestled among the red sandstone cliffs and riparian forests of southern Utah, measles took hold last summer. At the main school in Hilldale, a town along the Arizona border, just 30% of kindergartners are considered adequately immunized by Utah's health department, meaning they're gotten recommended vaccines against measles, tetanus, polio, and more. Exemptions from childhood vaccine requirements are easily acquired in the state. Parents need only claim personal, religious, or medical reasons. Many people in Hilldale and the surrounding towns are connected to the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a sect that has been leery of the government since a police raid in 1953 separated polygamous parents from their children. Shirley Draper, a southern Utah resident who grew up in the faith, said they became ever more isolated in the early 2000s under the leadership of Warren Jeffs. Before he was sentenced to life in prison for sexual assault against minors, Jeffs instructed his followers to withdraw from public schools and maintain mainstream medicine. "Growing up, we all got our vaccines," said Draper, who left the group during Jeffs' reign. "It wasn't until Warren Jeffs came along that there started to be more and more resistance." After Jeffs went to prison, many people left the faith, but remain concerned about vaccines because of online misinformation, such as claims that the shots are toxic. Today, a small shop in Hilldale sells mouth sprays and oral drops professing to detoxify vaccines. Water, glycerin, and whole grain alcohol are listed as ingredients in one called VXXDDTX. A mother who KFF Health News agreed not to name because she fears stigmatization, said she considered getting her kids vaccinated when schools in southwest Utah started seeing measles cases last summer. She had split from the fundamentalist group, but still worried about vaccines giving her children autism or other complications. Large studies published in top-tier scientific journals have refuted a link between vaccines and autism, but the anti-vaccine movement has kept the notion alive. "Then the woman's son told her that his classmate had a rash and spit on him," she said. "A few days later, he fell ill with a fever, followed by vomiting, diarrhea, and a head-to-toe rash. He felt downright sick for 10 to 14 days," the woman said. "It was hard to see the end of the tunnel." Then her daughters came down with measles. She had a fleeting case too, even though she had been vaccinated as a child. Breakthrough infections tend to be mild and are relatively rare. Only 4% of more than 4,300 plus U.S. cases reported this year and last have been people who've had two doses of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. By the time the family recovered, the son had missed nearly 3 weeks of school, the daughters a month, and the mother had postponed an important family gathering because she didn't want to spread infections. "I just got my youngest missed school report, and it's super high," she said. "This is the year of sickness." The woman said she regretted not getting her kids vaccinated when the outbreak started. She said she knows about 30 people who had fallen sick with the measles. "Except for a few who needed medical care, they haven't been tested. I bet there's been thousands of cases," she said. Measles doesn't have a cure. She and others have tried to ease symptoms with cod liver oil, vitamin C, zinc, and essential oils, plant extracts long used in folk medicine that have become a lucrative industry in Utah. "People in Southwest Utah are trying a lot of things. One resident sells homemade lotion on Facebook, writing, 'Breast milk and honey has been a lifesaver for the measles rash.'" Beyond containment. The outbreak may have started among a fundamentalist community, but it has spread far beyond because Utah's vaccination rates have dropped steadily since the COVID pandemic. Fewer than 80% of kindergartners were adequately immunized in the 2024-25 school year in southwestern Utah, with only 87% adequately immunized in the state as a whole, far below the 95% threshold required for herd immunity. Several Utahns told KFF Health News that alternative health or wellness drives the trend rather than religion. The state has a thriving supplement industry worth $6.1 billion in 2023, aided by derogatory policy supported by the late Utah Senator Orrin Hatch and a high concentration of people who earn income from multi-level marketing. These networks of people sell supplements, essential oils, peptides, and other alternative therapies on social media, YouTube, and podcasts, according to scholarly articles and industry analysis. Alternative health isn't necessarily anti-vaccine, but many people who sell unconventional remedies online and in podcasts deride vaccines and mainstream medicine. "People are suspicious, and it's well-founded," Draper said. She described dismissive doctors, exorbitant medical bills, hospital systems that put profits over care, and pharmaceutical companies that drove opiate addiction. Communities already worry if government authorities are poised to interpret failings in American healthcare as signs that medical authorities aren't to be trusted either, she said. "Across America, we have entire populations who find safety in clinging to whatever confirms their deeply held beliefs," she said. "A mistrustful disposition gave way to COVID conspiracy theories in 2020 and 2021. In Southwest Utah, for example, a pickup truck tricked out with digital billboards showed up to COVID vaccination sites to advertise Plendemic, a 26-minute viral video rife with conspiratorial claims, including that masks activate the coronavirus and that global elites planned COVID-19 to control the population. Misinformation added fuel to anger about public health rules, and there was political backlash under the umbrella of a largely Republican medical freedom movement. Utah enacted laws reigning in public health, including one that eases exemptions to childhood vaccinations and another that prohibits most employers from requiring vaccines. In the wake of the COVID backlash, health officials tread lightly. Rather than enforce containment measures, we give our advice and focus on personal responsibility, said David Heaton, public information officer at the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. One of the most contagious diseases in the world, measles spreads with astonishing speed among the unvaccinated. One meticulous study of a New York school outbreak in 1974 found that a second grader with measles infected 28 other students in 14 classrooms because measles can spread through ventilation systems. As cases doubled, then quadrupled in southern Utah, the regional health department couldn't keep up with calling the contacts of everyone infected. It shifted its efforts to announcements guiding the public at large. For example, it asked people to call before showing up to clinics with measles symptoms. Still, patients in plenty of hospitals have been exposed. For example, when parents brought a sick, unvaccinated child to a large pediatric hospital in Utah in September, they shared the space with 11 infants too young to be vaccinated. Doctors rushed to give the babies infusions of antibodies, and they remained healthy, according to a recent report. On the radio and in posts on social media, Heaton warns that measles is spreading and that vaccines are the best defense. If you're not immunized and you're anywhere in public, Heaton said, you're fair game for this virus. The department doesn't have the capacity to talk with people directly in the five counties it serves. For a few years, it leaned on community health workers who went to churches, town halls, and other gathering places, listening to people's concerns and telling them what the science said about COVID, vaccines, and other matters of public health. But these workers were laid off early last year after the Trump administration clawed back more than $12 billion in federal public health grants to states. We were starting to get a little bit of traction, Heaton said, of the community workers, and then we lost all of our team. The department offers measles vaccines to children for free, but uptake is slow. Nursing director Mindy Bundy said that when she started the job 20 years ago, demand was so high that she would give parents tickets while they waited, as if they were crowding around a deli counter. Not even in an outbreak, she said, we aren't seeing a huge increase of people wanting vaccination. As officials try to do the best they could, the outbreak spread north, hopping from one under-vaccinated community to the other, to the next. When health officials in Utah County spoke with people who had tested positive, they often had no connection to other known cases. Pretty quickly, we started to lose the links, said Michael Lehman, the county health department's nursing director. Contact tracing, the cornerstone of containment, was failing. Every week, the state health department posted a growing list of locations on its website, a Trader Joe's, a Mormon temple, an aquarium, preschools that people had visited while contagious. But many people who tested positive hadn't been to those places, Lehman said. They could have gotten it at Walmart. They could have gotten it walking through a mall, he said. I mean, just anywhere in the public, they could have been exposed. In February, high school students throughout Utah tested positive after a state wrestling tournament at Utah Valley University in Orem. A dashboard monitoring measles viruses in wastewater lit up with notifications around the state. Wrestling really feels like our turning point, said Nicholas Rupp, communications director at the Salt Lake County Health Department. Salt Lake County's shift from containment to mitigation meant prioritizing high-risk situations and relaxing control everywhere else. When a student has a confirmed case, for example, health officials meet with the school nurse to figure out which kids are most vulnerable. Unvaccinated children in the same classroom as someone infected are asked to stay home for 21 days, but those in other classrooms might not be, said Melanie Crossland, an epidemiologist at the Salt Lake Health Department. Some schools with high vaccination rates have opted to monitor student temperatures daily instead of requesting quarantines. One school created a separate space for the unvaccinated. Crossland said such bespoke strategies entail a huge amount of effort, but have staved off blowback that deflated her during COVID. We give everything when we're here, she said, but the days of killing ourselves, when legislatively no one is going to give us any help, are done. Daycare dilemma. The outbreak has lasted so long that some children who have recovered from measles have since been hospitalized for what should have been mild illnesses from common bugs, said Carrie Smith, a hospital pediatrician in southwest Utah. measles can erase the immune system's memory, impairing a body's ability to fight other viruses. It's making children very susceptible to getting sick again, Smith said. Her eyes were bloodshot, and she looked drained from a week of long shifts. Since the outbreak began, she has treated more than a dozen babies and children severely sick from measles. They're usually admitted to the hospital with measles pneumonia, so they're struggling to breathe, pulling for air below their ribs, she said. High fevers, 104 to 105, absolutely miserable, extremely fatigued, really dehydrated, with sunken eyes. Most children fully recover from measles, but a fraction develop permanent hearing loss, a small percentage die, and in rare cases, measles kills a person years after the infection. No one has died so far in Utah's outbreak. And barring that tragic outcome, Smith and other doctors said, some parents fail to grasp the gravity of measles, even as their own children have tubes inserted into their small nostrils to deliver oxygen. Despite repeated warnings, doctors said, some unvaccinated family members of patients who could be contagious walk around the hospital while visiting their loved one. This means the waiting room, the elevator, the cafeteria, and other places need to be shut down for cleaning and vulnerable people alerted. People don't realize how easily this spreads, Smith said. Morris, the pediatrician working in two counties, recalled a conversation with a nonchalant father who didn't seem to understand the need for quarantine. I know this is an inconvenience to you, she said. It's also a huge inconvenience to the parent who has an infant who could be severely impacted by this disease. On top of feeling depleted, doctors with young children said they are anxious. Emily Chin, a physician in Salt Lake County, worries she'll bring measles home to her newborn. One evening, she sat in her garage after caring for a child with a rash. The patient's measles test was still being processed, so Chin isolated herself in a room for the night, wearing an N95 mask instead of holding her infant. Like many mothers in Utah, Chin plans to give her baby an early dose of the measles vaccine at 6 months old because of the outbreak, in addition to two doses at ages 1 and 4. Several mothers said they avoid travel and public places because they fear their babies could be infected. Some are delaying daycare. Others, like Candace Hyland, a marketing director in Salt Lake County, don't have that option. Hyland was shocked when her daycare told her that it didn't track the vaccine status of staff, even amid the outbreak. In March, she posted an online petition calling for the state to require daycare staff to be vaccinated against the measles when the virus is spreading. Even if daycare staff filed for vaccine exemptions, she said parents could at least find out what portion of their baby's caretakers pose a life-threatening risk. Hyland sent her idea to the state health department. Nolan, the state epidemiologist, said she agreed with the concern and was talking with the Division of Licensing about the issue in an email shared with KFF Health News. Hyland also wrote the Division of Licensing and Background Checks. In an email, its director, Shannon Thoman Black, replied that the division does not have the legislative authority to implement a mandate. They always talk about parents' choice, Hyland said, but I don't feel like I have a really good parents' choice right now. Measles comeback. The U.S. will almost certainly lose its measles elimination status this year or next, but it could be regained if political leadership backed nationwide campaigns to boost confidence in vaccines, says Dimitri Daskalakis, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Immunization Center and now the chief medical officer at the Colin Lord Community Health Center in New York. Under Secretary Kennedy's leadership, that's unlikely to happen, he said. We're going back to a pre-vaccine era. HHS spokesperson Emily Hilliard defended the secretary and his agency in an email, writing that the CDC has surge resources to contain measles outbreaks. The CDC, HHS principals, and the secretary have been vocal that the MMR vaccine is the best way to protect yourself against measles, she said. Kennedy's words and actions suggest otherwise. He said that the measles vaccine leads to deaths every year, which is not true. He continues to tout a potential link between autism and vaccines, no matter how many studies conclude there is none. And he oversaw abrupt changes to the recommended childhood vaccine schedule, a move medical societies called dangerous and not backed by science. A federal judge blocked those changes in March, but Trump recently issued an executive order to re-examine the schedule. It's been confusing for the public, said Dorothy Adams, executive director of the Salt Lake County Health Department. In May, Kennedy met with Republican Utah Governor Spencer Cox, who has said little about the state's ongoing outbreak. Kennedy praised Utah's action on Make America Healthy Again priorities, such as banning fluoride in public drinking water and easing restrictions on raw milk sales, according to Salt Lake City's Deseret News. Cox declined to comment for this article. Meanwhile, the chronically depleted U.S. public health system has been further weakened by the Trump administration's cuts and delays to public health agents. If you're in the thick of it and you don't know if you will be reimbursed, you adjust your response, said Angela Dunn, a doctor and former Utah state epidemiologist. This outbreak is a perfect storm of disinformation, trauma from the COVID pandemic, and the drop in funding. Measles isn't the only preventable malady making a comeback. As children played nearby in a sun-speckled park in Salt Lake City, Morris talked about a baby in the intensive care unit who was bleeding uncontrollably after a fall. The baby's parents had refused an injection of vitamin K that helps blood clot in newborns. As they fretted over their infant, Morris said, she felt awful for them and regretted not being able to overcome mistrust in basic life-saving interventions. She had the same swirl of emotions when an unvaccinated toddler in her care recently died of whooping cough. I was one of the only people in the room with the nurse when the child coded, she said with tears in her eyes. You think, I wish this child was vaccinated, but it's hard because I also see how much grief those parents are holding.